everybody. I am Kathy Heekin, and I am recovering one day at a time in the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon. Thank you for your kind invitation to come to Oklahoma City. It's only the third time I've been to Oklahoma, and the second time was just in November. So it's nice to be back again. I feel like I have friends here in Oklahoma, just the short time that I've been here. Robin Turney, who hosted me actually when I was here in November, and then a group of people that I met while I was down at Lake Murray in fall. Shelley and I, Shelley and Teresa actually picked me up at the airport last night, and Shelley and I so far have had a wonderful time. We had a great experience over at Walmart this morning. I needed this cream because my face is so dry. So we went to Walmart, and Shelley has this pastime that has to do with coupons, so she really knows like a lot of stuff about prices. Those are the good things, Shelley. So there was a woman who was giving out free stuff. He had to play a price game. So I was like, oh my God, you know, it's like taking a savant into Las Vegas. I knew we were going to win, and we won all the games, and we won all the stuff. It was great. We broke the bank at Walmart. So it's just been a really exciting experience here. This is the second time I've been in Oklahoma where I've just these baskets that you prepare for the speakers. This must be the basket making capital of the world. They are so very nice. So I thank the committee for your wonderful generosity and hospitality. I have four sister-in-laws in Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of them always says that when she goes to a convention, she always goes to hear the Al-Anon speaker. And I'm thinking, what a wonderful, healthy thing to do. So I said, oh, that's great. And she said, yeah, that just makes me so grateful that I drank. I'm not sure what she means by that, but anyway, I am really grateful to be here. I've been taught in Al-Anon that it's important to look at the past without staring at it, and I've pretty much adopted that stance. I grew up in a really what I consider to be a terrific home. Certainly wasn't perfect. I don't know any of us come out of perfect homes, but I was one of six kids, and I had a lot of fun in that home. I grew up with parents who loved one another first, and then loved us. They were funny people. My mother is still alive. They are funny, funny. They were. They were like being raised by a vaudeville team. I mean, they just were funny in that disrespectful kind of Irish Catholic way where you're raised with a deep sense of tragedy. Actually, in my kitchen today, I have this quote that somebody brought back to me from Ireland. It's Yeats, and it said, being Irish, he had an abiding sense of tragedy, which was temporarily interrupted by moments of joy. And, you know, that's just the kind of thinking that preceded me, I guess, in my ancestors. They're a funny group of people. A lot of drinking in my particular culture, but my experience with it when I was little was a lot of those Irish relatives, when they drank, they were funny. They were funny people. They said funny things. They did outrageous things. And I don't remember as a little kid ever hearing stories where people were hurt, although I know from my own experiences that certainly must have happened somewhere along the road. So I'm raised in what I consider to be a pretty good family. I certainly was, however, a product of my time. I was raised in a family, and Shelley and I were talking about this. I was raised in a family where really we were never consulted about our feelings. Nobody really cared about our feelings when we were little. We were never allowed to go into a temper tantrum. We were never allowed to feel sorry for ourselves. Nobody really cared what our feelings were. And I don't really know today if that's a bad thing. I mean, you know, there's something about getting a little too self-absorbed that we were never allowed to do that. After deaths, after any tragedy that visited our home, nobody ever sat and said, how do you feel about that? We were just taught to go on. And my mother used to always say, it'll be better before you're married. I mean, when we were little. If you'd cry about anything, she'd say, it'll be better before you're married. And that was the attitude. It was like, I was also raised by a string of nuns who taught me the importance of sacrifice, of putting other people ahead of myself. It's interesting because over Christmas break, I went to lunch with a group of friends, and there were three of us really. Two of us are in the program, one is not. And I happened to get to lunch first, and it's one of those cafeteria things, and I thought I was late. So I went ahead, with the lunch, and then once I had my tray, I was looking for the others, and then realized that I was there first, so I popped down and got a table. And this friend that came along, who's not in the program, she said, "I can't believe that you went ahead and you got your lunch and you didn't wait for me. See, that's what Al-Anon does. That's what Al-Anon does." And I said to her, "Nancy, Al-Anon doesn't teach you to be selfish, and Al-Anon doesn't teach you to be rude. Al-Anon teaches you the importance of taking care of yourself and leading a healthy and spiritual life." Now, I don't usually talk to my friends that way, but it was so important to me to straighten that up, because I know that there's a huge difference. I know today there's a huge difference. I was raised being taught that there was great value in suffering. But it had to be silent suffering or it didn't count. I mean, you couldn't suffer and talk about it. You had to suffer and not talk about it, or you just did, you erased it. So somewhere along the line, I never got a sense I never really was taught, or maybe I was, but I wasn't paying any attention, about the importance of learning to take care of yourself. That the old rule of love your neighbor as yourself implies a great sense of respect and dignity that's directed towards self first. Growing up, I had a great time. I don't know how else to say it. Raised by these funny people who were pretty disrespectful. The best story that describes that is when my father's only brother died at age 48 of a sudden heart attack. This uncle of mine had been president of the Hibernians. I don't know if you're familiar with the Hibernians. It's this Irish group of men who's, I don't really know what they do. I know they get together a lot and celebrate being Irish. Maybe they're supposed to hold on to Irish culture. I'm not sure. But they wear these plumed hats, and they have swords, and they march around KFC halls a lot. So when my uncle died, because he was a past president of the Hibernians, they took care of the entire funeral. They planned the liturgy of the Mass. They planned the wake, the rosary that was said at the funeral home. And as I was standing with my father, right by that open casket of his only brother, who is now dead, I said to my dad, looking around the room at all these plumed hats, I said, "My God, these Hibernians have done such a wonderful job with this funeral planning." And my dad said, "This is nothing. At dawn, they're going to execute a Protestant." You know, that's my family. No matter how bad it looks, somebody's got to say something that's funny. And that's an important thing for me to remember, is that I come from people who take things and I learned to tell funny stories. So, as an adult, when my heart was breaking, I learned to just turn it and make it sound like it was a really funny story. I have a woman in my home group who says that character defects are really overused and overworked assets. And I have heard that before, and I think in many respects in my own case that it's probably true. At any rate, so I'm growing up in this crazy family, and my father, as an aside, also happened to be a newscaster. I have no idea how that, a newsman, I should say, I don't know how that impacted much, except that we never had what we'd call a regular home life because his hours were so bizarre, and even when he wasn't working, if there was a fire, if there was a flood, he was gone. And it didn't matter if it was the 4th of July or Christmas Eve or Easter Sunday. If there was a news-breaking story, he had to go. He had to leave. But he'd always come back with all these stories about some pretty incredible people and what they had done. And he never judged people. He never came back and said, "Boy, I just interviewed this really horrible man." He'd come home and say, Oh, I just interviewed this man who chopped his wife up into 40 different pieces and put her in a trunk and sent her to Cleveland. And we were like, wow, what ingenuity. I mean, I don't know, it's just, wow, what a thing. So, as a teenager, I was a kid that always pretty much followed the rules. But I always had this attraction for people that broke the rules in bizarre ways. And I can remember hearing about my husband long before I ever went out with him. I remember hearing about a guy who, on a $50 bet, had jumped off the tallest bridge that spanned the Ohio River. And I mean, he broke a few ribs and was spitting up blood for a week, but I remember hearing about this guy and thinking, wow, what a dude, as my students would say. And so when I met him in the flesh and blood, one of his sisters called me and said, my brother's going to be in town. He was in training to become a Marine Corps pilot. I thought, oh, I bet this will be so much fun. And when he came to the door to greet, when I went to the door, he was on the outside, he was holding in his hand this silver monogrammed cup. So that was filled with bourbon. And then I was 20 years old, and I thought, wow, what a Marine. This is going to be so much fun. So we went out, and you know what? It was exciting to go out with him. It really was. I mean, he always had his private pilot's license, and one time he said, hey, I have an idea. When he was home on leave, he said, why don't I rent a little plane and we'll go up? I'd never been in an airplane. I mean, I never went anywhere. So we rented this plane. We went to Lunkin Airport, which is this little airport in Cincinnati. And we got into, I don't know, like a little Cherokee thing, a two-seater. And we taxied out, and we got over the Ohio River. And he said, did you ever hear of a stall? I said, no. So he said, well, watch this. Now, he installed the plane, and then it would appear as though we were going to die very soon because, you know, we would be heading for the river. And then he'd pull it up. I thought I was going to die, on the one hand. On the other hand, I never had more fun in my whole life. This one is like dating him. So I thought, wow, marriage would even be more fun. The only thing that bothered me was that he had this temper. And it was not always connected to the drinking. You just never knew when this temper was going to appear. But I was pretty sure, because I had a history of getting along well with a lot of different kinds of people. I just had a sense that once we were married, whatever that anger of his was about, it would be okay. I mean, it's one thing to date, but, I mean, once you're married, I mean, it's a sacrament. Things would change. Oh, there's a Catholic in the back. I know it. Anyway, so, but things would change. And so we decided pretty quickly to get married. Now, I had never really lived in town with him because he was in the Marine Corps, so he was always in Beeville, Texas, or Pensacola, Florida, or somewhere else. But I think that I knew that he was the man that I wanted to spend the rest of my life with. Because in addition to being exciting, he was also a very funny man. He was also a very smart man. He was a highly talented man. And he also was a very, very kind man. He was a lot of things. And sometimes I think when people identify themselves as being a friend of, or the wife of, or the husband of, or the mother of an alcoholic, my husband was much more than an alcoholic. He was a lot of things. He was a lot of things. When he drank, there was trouble. That's all I know. When he drank, there was trouble. But beyond that, he was a lot of things. Actually, I didn't know that we were going to get married. He announced it. One time he invited me over for dinner when he was home at Christmas, and he said to his family, I have an announcement to make. I thought he had been promoted within the Marine Corps. And he said, Kathy and I are going to get married. Well, I mean, we had talked about it a little bit, but I didn't know it was like, we were going to announce it. But I thought, I can do that. And that seems a little odd to me today, except for this fact that I'd spent my life really paying very close attention to how things looked. And so for me to stand up in the midst of his very large family and say, wait a minute, we haven't really discussed it at length. I would never have done that. I didn't have the wherewithal to do that when I was 20 years old. I just didn't. I was one that was always willing to let you make decisions about me, because then you would always be responsible, and I could never be held accountable. Now, I didn't know that when I was 20, but I know that today. It's really easy to let somebody else make decisions for you, because then you never have to be accountable for what you're doing or for who you're becoming. And so we got married very quickly because we knew that he was going to get orders to Vietnam. We just didn't know when they were going to come. And I knew within 10 days of my marriage that I was in over my head. I was in trouble. That's all there is I can tell you. We were stationed at Cherry Point, North Carolina, and an incident came up where I had opened a wedding gift that had arrived in the mail without his being there, and he came home and had a fit. I was very surprised at his reaction. I was more surprised when I went outside of the trailer in which we were living to pick up some of the straw that had blown out of the box, and he had locked me out. I didn't know a lot of things, but I knew this, that I knew most people did not behave this way 10 days into their marriage. And so I left. I walked out of that trailer park, and I found a little Sears catalog store that was opened. There wasn't much going on there. It was just a counter. So I went on down to a furniture store and wandered around couches and end tables. And I just remember as though it were yesterday. And I thought, what am I going to do? Something is wrong here. Something is really, really wrong here. And something is so wrong here, all my being funny and telling funny stories isn't going to fix it. I have to get out of here. I have to escape. I'll get one of his checks when he leaves for work tomorrow, and I'll get to New Bern, North Carolina, and I'll fly home. But what stopped me is what stopped me for the next 12 and a half years until I found you, and that was, how will that look? You've been married 10 days, and you bail out? How will that look? Now, you have to understand one thing. I come from a family, and this was really brought home to me 2 summers ago when we had a family reunion and we brought in all of our people to Cincinnati. And one cousin-in-law of mine had tracked my family tree back to Ireland, for the last, 200 years. And it covered the entire 2 walls of the parish hall. And my brother pointed out, as he emceed this reunion, that in that entire tree, there was not one divorce. Yeah. Which, as my brother said, either points out that we have been incredibly lucky or we have a tremendous capacity for suffering. I'm just stopped dead cold in my tracks. And all these little things that I heard growing up, like make the best of it, put a good face on it, rise above it. Or, you made your bed, you have to lie in it. That's a big one, making that bed. I don't make my bed in the morning anymore, it's a bad habit. So, what I did was this. I ignored those instincts, and I went back to that trailer, knocked on the door, he let me in, and I just acted as if that really had never happened. I took those feelings of panic and fear, and most importantly, those feelings that I don't always hear in the meetings, but they're there, those deep feelings of grief. And I just swallowed them, and I went on and pretended like everything was just fine. Just like everything was fine. Because I really didn't know what else to do. I just didn't know what to do. So I tried to stay out of his way. I tried to avoid anything that would cause scenes. I spent 12 and a half years, as my kids like to point out, waiting for the clue bus without a ticket. I just didn't know what else to do. I laid low. But I'll tell you a dangerous and damaging thing that happened in my marriage is that I spent 12 and a half years with 1 foot in the marriage and 1 foot out of the marriage. And that's no way to conduct an intimate relationship. Because every time something like this would come up, and it didn't happen every day, but they happened enough that I would always wonder, is this big enough to break apart this marriage? Is this incident
big enough. I was always building a case so that when and if I finally had to leave, you would understand, that you would see that and you would be on my side and you would tell me that I was all right. That I should have gotten a divorce. What else could I do? I was always gathering evidence. I can only imagine what it's like to live with somebody who's always gathering evidence against you. It mustn't be a whole lot of fun. Anyway, he left for Vietnam. Oh my God, I was so relieved. Now that, I know, is not a normal reaction for a bride. I mean, it wasn't. And then that's when the line starts, because I'm surrounded by these Navy and Marine Corps wives who are like, oh my God, the pineapple squadron, what are we going to do, what are we going to do? And I'm thinking, oh, I can't wait to get back home. But I can't say that, so I'm like, oh, I don't know, you know, maybe I'll go back to school. I was so bewildered. I think that's the best word I can use to describe. I was only married 3.5 months. I was so bewildered by it all. And then I think I got pregnant a good 3 weeks into my marriage, so I'm bewildered and I have morning sickness. And I just wanted to go. There's no worse combination. I just wanted to go home. And so he left, and I did. I went home, and I made a beeline for the priest that married me. And as I was walking out the door, my parents, my mother was like, I hope you're not going to tell that priest anything personal. I was like, oh no. I'm just going for the morning sickness blessing. So, you know, I went to the priest. I said, really, honestly, I don't know what's going on, but something is very, very bad. Something's very, very bad. I mean, there's all this horrible tension and there's all this arguing, and I didn't grow up that way. I mean, I grew up, you know, with Ricky and Lucy. I mean, I didn't grow up this way. And he said, well, you know, you come from a long line of really assertive women. Maybe you just need to take a back seat in this marriage. I mean, he kept, you know, every time I went somewhere until I found you, I would hear all this advice, you know, I statements. You know, you got to make I statements. So I'd go home and I'd say, I hate you. That was a good I statement. Because, you know, I was always sure it was something that some key, and I'd talk to his sisters, you know, and they'd always tell me about his childhood and how difficult it was being raised by, you know, a father who drank and by a mother who drank, and, you know, he got, you know, I always thought maybe somewhere in his childhood, of course, not mine, in his childhood there was the key to all this, and, it was just exhaustive work. Just exhaustive work, trying to figure it all out. You can only imagine the relief that I felt when I came to you and you told me I didn't have to figure it out. What I had to do was to be about my own recovery from the family disease of alcoholism. What an absolute relief. My husband came back from Vietnam and decided to become a dentist. I don't know why. But right before we went up to Ohio State Dental School, he went over to Newport, Kentucky and got into a terrible brawl with a bouncer over there, and it did a lot of damage to his one eye, and he had to have surgery before he could go into dental school. And, you know, it was just always those things that kept coming up, you know. He'd come home at night and he'd have this one eye covered and bandaged, and he'd come home and he'd have his hand bandaged and he'd have to go in the hospital because he had hit somebody and a human bite is so dangerous. I mean, it was always like this strain of things that I was constantly having to create these elaborate stories, which I come later to find out nobody is buying, but I think everybody is. it's just, you know, it just wore me out. It just began to wear me out. Once, and brilliant that he was, he graduates. When he went to dental school after this last incident, he didn't drink while he was in dental school. There was no drinking. I thought it was directly related to me, of course, for being patient and loving and long-suffering and silent. But when we got back to Cincinnati, the behavior returned. Worse than ever before. So I, one more time, am scrambling to try to change things, to try to keep the kids out of his way, to try to protect my own reputation, honestly, from anything that he might do, trying to look like I knew it was going on, because what would you think of me? You know, it was the same thing you and I used to get into a car with him when he was just so drunk. Now, why wouldn't somebody figure how dangerous it is? Not me. I thought I had to get into a car with him when he was drinking, because if I didn't, I'd have to ask you for a ride home. And how would that look? What was wrong with me that my husband had to drink so much? That's the kind of thinking, that attitude, that really began to grow and to mushroom in my mind. All that crazy thinking, that terrible responsibility that I took on for somebody else's decisions and for somebody else's disease. But I didn't know that because I hadn't met you. And I'm going on just, you know, strings and pieces of wisdom that I remembered from here and there. You know, I'm reading, you know, anything I get my hands on, trying to search for an answer. And no answer's coming. And eventually, of course, what happened turned out was that my husband now, with a license to practice dentistry, is writing prescriptions for himself for all kinds of narcotics. And he's just getting up in the morning, he tells me later, and just, you know, a handful of pills just to get through the day. Well, it wasn't very long before he was picked up by the Reno agents in Cincinnati, arrested, and thrown out of dentistry. They took his license away. But what then occurred was that he, that began years of unemployment. Now, he had moved back to Cincinnati, and as he was starting his practice, his father, used to raise quarter horses. And so we lived on this large piece of property outside of the city of Cincinnati. It was gorgeous. It overlooked the Ohio River and the hills of Kentucky, and it was mainly pasture land for these quarter horses. But as Rick's brothers and sisters would get married, each of them was given some land, and then when they could afford to, they'd build a little house on this property. Well, while you were waiting to amass enough money, there was this little tiny summer house next to the main house where you could live while you were saving money. Well, we lived there for a long time. Because he didn't work. And his father died shortly after we moved in. And his mother, with her heart of gold, eventually we didn't have to pay rent, we didn't have to pay the electric bill, we didn't have to pay anything because we couldn't. We had a house full of kids. But if you'd come to see us, it looked great. As you got in the car, you know, if you got in your car to visit me, you'd wind through these wonderful pastures with the split rail fences and all these quarter horses, and you'd come up to this little cute summer house overlooking the river with the pool and little tennis courts and stables, and it looked great. But we had nothing. My husband was hunting fox and selling their furs to live. Now, that's a booming industry in the 1700s, but I'll tell you, in the 1980s, you got to stretch that budget. I mean, it's crazy. This is crazy. Boy, there I am out there making it sound like it's the greatest life, you know. My husband's a trapper. What's your husband? My husband's a trapper. Oh, he's into furs. I mean, you know, I'm always making it sound like it's this wonderful thing. And it was insane. I mean, even my kids were getting to the age where they're like, Mom, what is Dad doing? I mean, their friends don't like to come because if you'd walk into the side of the house with all these... Have you ever seen a fox without its fur on?
Oh,
yeah. I mean, it could be anything hanging up there. It's just, oh, my God. It's awful. And at the time, of course, now, because we're living in an area that's being subdivided left and right, these normal people, I mean, his family thought it was real normal, but they're moving in, you know, these regular people are moving in, and they're talking about this crazy family that lives up over the river, and they've got these steel leg hold traps, and you let your kids play up there? No, I let my kids play up there. You let your kids? No, I'm afraid they'll step in a leg hold trap. So I call them the Stepford Wives, because I really am wondering why they'd move to the country if they're afraid of, you know, guns and steel leg hold traps. You just, I mean, you ever step in one, you just open it up and pull the little kid's
limb out of it. But at any rate, so I'm trying to make it sound like it's just a normal way to live here, you know, in the 1980s in Cincinnati, Ohio. And if kids bring friends home and Rick happens to be hunting out the window, I just tell him to move to the other side of the house because Dad's working. And one time, there was a family that had, well, the cats, I don't even like to talk about the cats because it always hurts somebody's feelings in out there who likes cats. I pretty much like them too, but Rick's feeling was if they're house cats, they're fed at home. So they really have no business being out hunting pheasant and quail. And the penalty in his world for that is death. So I would have, you know, neighbors calling and saying, "Hi, you know, this is Muffy down in the new subdivision. Have you seen Boots?" Oh, my God. I mean, I know Boots is never returning home. I don't know exactly where Boots is, but Boots... and at night, you know, somebody said, "Well, how's it killing those cats at night?" And it's like the infrared glasses. I mean, it's modern technology. But one time, it was a terrible thing. Pretty soon, I just didn't want to answer the phone anymore because I was so afraid about who was going to call. I mean, and that's, for me, as a big phone person, not to be able to answer your own phone out of fear and anxiety about who's going to be on the line. It's just an awful way to live. And for my children, oh my God. I remember one time a woman who had a cat, but she actually had a barn. She was renting one of the old places on the original driveway. She had a barn cat that was always around. And Rick, because he wasn't working other than the spur thing, he one time found this little bird. I mean, he was a talented guy. He found a bird, I think one of the kids did, and they brought it in, and he trained this bird to, you know, come to him when he would take his keys or a piece of glass or anything. This blue jay would live in the trees, and when Rick would whistle or take out a piece of glass, that thing would come and land on his shoulder. It was BJ the blue jay, that's what we used to call it. He would follow him all around. It was really a cute thing. Well, one day, it was in the summer, he wanted to take the kids, he said, "I'm going to take all the kids down swimming." And he said, "There's that barn cat in the yard. Get rid of it." Now, I don't know about you, but when somebody tells me to do something I know I can't do, I get very, very anxious because I like to be able to do things. You know what I mean? I mean, that's one of the reasons I'm here. I like to be able to do the job and do it right. I like looking good and being right. I mean, they're my biggest flaws, you know? So when he says to me, "Get rid of the barn cat," I don't know how to get rid of a wild cat, but I know he wants me to get rid of it because that bird is sitting down with him and all the little kids playing by the water. So I go and I try to chase this cat away and I'm like, you know, "Go home, go home, it's dangerous up here. Go home, go home." You know, I thought I'd got rid of it. Well, I go down to the water and he's in there with all the kids and all of a sudden I hear coming from the depths of his being this shriek. And I look over and, dang gone, if that barn cat hasn't, I mean, just like that, out from a bush, bit that little trained bluebird, right in half. Well, you know how when there's going to be trouble? I mean, you know when you're just... You know, you live in Oklahoma, you know dust storms. I mean, you know, you see them coming down on the plane, and I have no idea. Cincinnati is built on 7 hills. I've never seen a dust storm in my life, but I read the grapes are there. So I have a feeling that you see it coming, and you think, oh, no. So I nearly got in the water with the kids, and I saw Rick go up to the house and get one of those guns that he used to keep in the bedroom, and he comes down out that back door with that gun on his shoulder, and he says, "Kitty, kitty, 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 kitty." So I say to the kids, "Okay now, I have an idea. Let's have a tea party. Let's all join hands and let's go underwater for this great little tea party." And I took those little kids and I kept them underwater with me, you know, pretending like we were all having a tea party. And even through that, underwater, you could hear that gun go off. And he just left it. He just left it. Of course, every kid, you know, all the first cousins, I mean, I'm living on a compound. Everybody, all the kids, you're like, there's 90,000 first cousins standing around. There's this cat, 90 million pieces. And they're my kids, you know. And what do you say? I mean, what do you say? My husband wasn't drinking that day. He just got mad at a cat, and he blew it in who knows how many pieces. And the kids are looking at me like, Mom, why does he do that? What's wrong with Dad? What's wrong with Dad? I have no idea what to say. I spent years trying to interpret his words and his actions, always in the middle, trying to make sense of it for them, trying to tell them what they saw and what they heard. Really wasn't what they saw at all. Really wasn't what they heard at all. It's just, you know, that constant trying to be in the middle, and it's just exhausting work. And it was just wearing me out. Thank God one of the sisters finally joined Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God. Because then another sister joined, and another sister joined, and another sister joined. And then they came for me. And you know, I always say, and you know it's true, it is supposed to be, the tradition says, traction rather than promotion. But I'll tell you, did you ever meet somebody that just got an AA? Oh my God. So anyway, my little kids used to say, that carries me. Ooh, that carries me. Anyway, so they're coming to me now, and they're talking about alcoholism, and they're talking about it being a family disease, and how they've been in their family for years, and, you know, how sick my husband was, and blah, 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 blah. And how it's probably going to be passed on. Now, at this very time, I'm pregnant with child number 7, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, I know, it's hard for you to believe anybody does anything that's over the top. Anyway, so I'm thinking, oh my God, family disease? I'll never get away from this. Because I had this 8-year plan that I always figured, because Rick was 4 years older than I was, and women generally outlive men by 4 years, I always thought at the end of my life I'd have these 8 years. That would be just calm and peaceful, and I could answer the phone again, and, you know, it would just be so restful. And now they're talking about it being a disease in a family, and I'm devastated, because there goes my 8-year plan, and what am I to do? And that fear of looking ahead got me to my very first Al-Anon meeting. And I went to a beginner's meeting, and it was there that for the first time I was told that alcoholism was a disease that I did not cause, that I did not cure, that I could not cure, and that I could not control. I never thought I'd cause my husband's drinking. He was drinking the first date that I met him, but I always thought that if I loved him enough, that love conquered all. That if I loved him patiently and unconditionally, that he would not have to drink, that would be enough for him. And what you told me was, his drinking was absolutely none of my business. That I had to place him in the hands of a loving and compassionate God, and I had to be about my own recovery. That I was in the right place because I had been deeply affected, deeply and profoundly affected by the disease of alcoholism. And it's that the relief that I felt in my very first meeting, it's just untold. I mean, I can't even put it into words. I was telling Shelley, I taught yesterday, I teach 18-year-olds, and I love them. They are funny, a funny age. But they're not easy. And it took me 6.5 hours to get here, and I don't like to fly. But I thought to myself, I was blowing my little thing out in Dallas, you know, to get on this tiny little prop plane. I thought, why am I doing this? But then I know why I'm doing this, because this program of recovery has absolutely saved my life and the life of my family. And to come for a little piece of time and just share with you what it has meant for me is nothing. It's nothing compared to what I've gotten. It's nothing. The relief that I felt, oh my God. I started going to that meeting, and I'll tell you, things changed. Things changed. My vision changed. My attitude began to change. Because now I'm hanging around with men and women who are telling me to let go and let God. Keep reminding me to get out of the way. I'm really convinced that some of the reasons we have to do some of the things we do, just to keep us busy, so we get out of the way, so God's grace isn't blocked by me,
by me. And so I did what you told me to do. I took a phone list. I read the literature. I got some woman to be my sponsor. I started going to meetings. But more importantly than all of that, I began to change my heart. I began to have a change of heart. And that, for me, is lifelong work. That daily conversion is lifelong work. But you're the ones that gave me that. You gave me a spiritual program that I hold on to today. Wow. I had a woman that kept saying to me, don't argue with him. No matter what he says, don't argue with him. Just say to him, you could be right. So I practiced that. I'd go home and he'd say, my whole family's gone crazy because now he's got four sisters in AA. I mean, it is hilarious. It is so great, you can't imagine it. You're just like being smothered with recovery. Really, I mean, it's just so, we're just so excited. And so I would just say to him, he'd say, my sisters, and I'd say, honey, you could be right. And then I'd go do something, read a book. I mean, I had hours of time on my hands because I was no longer always watching, you know, playing that role of the keeper of truth and justice in the family. I mean, you know, the kids would say, why did Dad do that? And now I'd say, well, I don't know, honey. Why don't you ask Dad? What a concept. I mean, really? And I'll tell you, that isn't always easy for me, because my kids were little. But I would call. I mean, if my sponsor wasn't there, I would just call anybody. And nobody really ever told me what to do. And that's the beauty of the program. What people would do would share with me what worked for them. That's all. They would just say, well, I don't know, but this is what works for me. This is what I do that seems to work. And that's the kind of stuff that I would pick up. That's why I love that, you know, take what you like, leave the rest. I often say to people, what can you live with? What can you live with? When I hear somebody say, oh, throw that 14-year-old kid out in the street, I think, what? I don't know about Oklahoma, but in Ohio, you can't throw 14-year-olds out the street. I mean, really, I had a string of them that I wanted. You can't. You got to keep them. Sorry, I had to keep them. I just used to say to people, what can you live with? What can you live with? You know, my son's in jail. He's gone for bail money. Should I give it to him or not? What can you live with? Well, if I give him that bail money and he starts drinking again, I'll hate him. I guess maybe I won't. Or, I don't know, if he ends up in jail and he gets hurt, I'd never forgive myself. I mean, people generally know what they can live with, and that's what you got to go with, I think. You can only be where you are. That's all. You can only be where you are. I wasn't very far 6 months in. I was just 6 months in when I was 6 months in. But things began to change. Things began to change. I'll tell you, the grief of living. I have a sister-in-law who died 3 years ago of breast cancer. And my brother, she struggled with it for 2 years. They had three little kids. And, you know, it was rough. I mean, as you can imagine, it was rough. And my mother says to me, I don't know why she says it to me, but she'll say to me every once in a while, you don't know what it's like. You don't know what it's like to watch a spouse die. And I think, well, you could be right, Mom. I know it must be difficult. But when I get off the phone, I think, oh, yes, I do. Oh, yes, I do. I watched somebody die for years of this disease, and it's not easy. There is no inoculation for the pain of it. There's no inoculation for the pain of it. I've seen two of my sons brought before a judge in handcuffs. There's no inoculation for that kind of pain. There's a lot of grief involved with this disease. But the hope lies in the fact that we never have to walk through those moments alone. I swim in the morning in a very, very old Y that was built in 1929. And in the tile work in the wall, it says, do not swim alone. And that wisdom is what I carry with me to this day. You don't have to swim alone. As a matter of fact, it's dangerous to do so. None of us have to face this alone. And that's the beauty, the community that I find, the fellowship that I find of men and women who know what it's like to bury people as a result of this disease, who share in our joy for those that recover, and who continue to lead lives of quiet grace, a great deal of compassion, mercy, hope, and joy. It's a wonderful place for me to be.
It's a wonderful place for me to be. On Tuesday night, a woman came in who's been in Al-Anon for about 35 years. I haven't seen her recently. Her second son died of this disease on December the 26th. And she said to me, I'm thinking if I had called him more often, I'm thinking if I had been more forceful with him. And I said to her, just keep coming back. Just keep coming back. Let's drown those voices out. Just keep coming back and know that eventually you'll hear what you need to hear and God will sort that out for you. That's all I know, is that if I continue to listen, if I continue to keep showing up, if I continue to maintain my spiritual life, God will sort things out for me. When I did a fourth step, I had no idea how accountable I was, my actions, and how much my actions had continued this mess. It really was just that. It was just a mess. You know, in Al-Anon we talk about the four M's, muttering, martyrdom, managing, and manipulation. And they're big ones for me. I can only speak for myself. They're big ones for me. I had no idea how much I was doing that because it never looked like that. It never looked like I was manipulating, but I was. It never looked like I was managing, but I was. It never looked like I was mothering, but I was. And it never looked like I was being a martyr, but I was. I was. You're the ones that taught me that everybody has the right not to recover. Everybody has the right not to recover. But the insanity for me comes when I forget that. He also taught me the importance of turning my life over and my life and my will over to the care of a loving God. And I'm just one that believes that the will of God has an awful lot to do with it has an awful lot to do with becoming the woman that God created me to be. And you have restored to me that idea and that hope of the kind of woman I believe that God invites me, challenges me, and really wants me to be. But I don't know how to do that without you, really. I don't know how to do that without staying off of a spiritual path. And I have a friend that always says, I have to keep coming to meetings because I leak. I leak. I forget what I hear. I go to meetings, I'm like, yes, that's right. I'm going to change my life. And she said, remember, in a few days, I leak. I forget it all. So I have to keep coming back. And I understand that. I understand what that's like. My sponsor always says to me, lay that at the feet of alcoholism. A lot of the habits that I've picked up, a lot of my defects really are overworked assets. Lay that at the feet of alcoholism. I had to learn to forgive myself before I could forgive anybody else. I had to have an attitude that you gave me, an attitude of humility, knowing that nothing is going to happen to me today that God and I together won't be able to walk through. The humility that I have learned has really been rooted in the fact that I believe in a God today whose grace really can take me from A to Z. On my own, I can't do it. You were the ones that taught me on the making that list of people that I had harmed. I had to put myself somewhere in there. But in actuality, by working the steps and practicing the principles, it was the most powerful way to make amends to myself. And it was at the same time the most powerful way to make amends to my children. Because my children have been hurt by this disease and they've been hurt by me. Because I, even though I was physically there, I was never really emotionally there for him. I was always in the future worried about it or in the past nursing old wounds. I didn't spend a lot of time in the present. And that's what you have taught me to do. You've taught me to live in the present. You've taught me the most powerful thing I can do for my kids is to give them a healthy parent to continue to recover. And you also certainly had shown me all the ways that I had contributed because of what you'd share, never because of what you pointed out to me, but because of what you were willing to share about your own truth. I began to see the role that I had played in really creating a lot of misery for my husband, that I had given him the responsibility for making me happy, and that was never his responsibility. It was never his responsibility. I gave him a job he couldn't do, and when he failed at it, which he certainly would, I blamed him for it in a million different ways. I would ignore him. I wouldn't, you know, if I was having a lot of fun and he'd walk in the room, I'd shut down. I turned to ice. I ignored him. I really erased him as a human being. That's a terrible thing to do to somebody. I raised him as a human being, and you taught me how to make those amends, how to make those living amends. But I needed to go to him beyond that and say, I'm really sorry, I'm going to try to do better here. And you know what? We never became Romeo and Juliet, but I'll tell you what, we really began one more time to put together some sort of an honest relationship. My husband actually went to AA for about a minute. It scared him. Oh, my God, scared him to death. Oh, he said, those people are so happy. That can't be right. I think he grew up with that suffering thing, too, you know. Anyway, so, but he was doing the best that he can. He used to have this little pastime. He used to fly in his homemade helicopter that he made. It's really just like a lawn chair. And it's got a blade and a motor. I mean, I always say, if it's dangerous, if it can kill you and maim you, he's right behind it 100%. I mean, he just loves doing that stuff. So he did that for a couple of years, and he was very good at it. But one, and I used to think, oh, he, you know, there he goes, offline again. Here I am stuck with all seven of these kids. You know, that's not fair. But you're the ones that used to say to me, Kathy, if it brings him any peace at all, why would you want to take it away from him? He's not a bad man. He's a sick man. And if it lightens the load for him, don't wreck it for him. And so I believe that you were right, that at least for a moment he could be happy. At least for a moment he would find some respite from the emotional trauma that he seemed to carry with him all the time. One Memorial Day weekend, as he walked out the door, it was a day really much like today with blue skies. It was gorgeous. And as he walked out the door, I said to him, Ricky, have a ball. You had a beautiful day. And those were the last words that ever spoke to Rick, because 2.5 hours later, as I was coming up that driveway with a station wagon full of kids, I had the police behind me. And when we got up to the house, you know, I got out of the car, and the man said, why don't you send your kids inside? And I knew, even before his mouth started to move, I knew what he was going to tell me, that Rick had died. And a few minutes after he told me that news, my husband's mother, my mother-in-law, who was not well, was coming up the driveway, and one of them went over to speak to her. And when I finally got to her, she put her arms out, and I remember she had her little cane draped over her wrist. If you've ever had a child in trouble, you know that they just kind of weasel their way right into your heart. She put her arms around me and she said, thank God he's out of his pain. And I've held on to that over the years, because the peace and the serenity that I have seen members of this family receive as a result of this program, for some reason, eluded him. I don't know why. It just eluded him. But I know that where he is now, he is in the arms, finally, of a loving and peaceful God. And that serenity that he couldn't find here, he has now. And most days, that's enough for me. Shortly after my husband's death, I can't get into that. It's just, in a general way, I can tell you that I had a lot of kids that got into trouble. Also a lot of kids that didn't get into trouble, but the ones that did, of course, it just involved a lot of court appearances and probation officers and placement and things like that. But, you know, looking back on it, it really wasn't a living. It was okay one day at a time, because you were with me. Because you are the ones that continue to say to me, Kathy, if you become your children's higher power, they'll never find a higher power on their own. You're the ones that told me that there is a line between parenting and enabling. It's a narrow line, but that I had to continue to parent. I had to continue to take action and let go of the results. I had to continue to take action and let go of the results. I always cooperated with the courts. That's what you told me to do. I always showed up. I always tried to, as best I could, take action with my kids that would not lead to a resentment down the road. My insurance pays for one shot in the hospital, you know. And so when that one shot was over, I would say to the son, whatever son it happened to be, now that was insurance. So, you know, milk it for what it's worth, because when that's done, it's done. Because I know that AA is free. And that's tremendous, you know, it's a tremendous for me. It was a tremendous relief to know that people were there. And so when insurance was shot, that was that. People would say to me, well, you know, you can send them to this place, it'll cost you $10,000, but you can send them over here, they do pretty good work with kids. And I would have to think, gee, if I mortgaged my house for $10,000 and the kid came home and drank the next week, would I have a resentment? That's what I see you today. I mean, I still, always. And you know, the beauty of that is that I can love my children and not have to resent them. But I always get out of the way of their consequences because my children, all of them, have the right not to recover. And I've had a couple who've been in AA who have decided that they're no longer alcoholic. And I simply say to them, well, you could be right. I don't know. But I also know that I do not have to participate in their soap opera. I choose to stay out of that. And I can do that because you've shown me how to do that in a very loving way. Parent my kids without enabling them. Parent my kids without rescuing them. Once my son was sent to a court-ordered thing, and a man came to speak, and he was talking about being a lifeguard, being trained as a lifeguard. It made sense to me because I was trained as a lifeguard. And he said, you know, when you're a lifeguard, they teach you when somebody's in deep water, drowning, don't ever go in there. Because in their panic and in their fear, they'll drown you. So stay where you can and throw them a line, you know, throw a buoy out to them, give them a pole. But don't go in there with a drowning person because you're drowned as well. And I remember that in regards to my own children. That I can do all kinds of things in a loving way. But in the old days in Al-Anon, they used to call detachment releasing with love. There are all kinds of ways to release my children with love. I visit them when they're in jail. I talk to them. We have these great conversations. But I never, ever, ever lie to them. I don't manipulate them. And I never do things that will lead to a later resentment because I care about my relationship with my children. This one child of mine who's just been drinking, not drinking, drinking, not drinking, he came home at Christmas, now he's 21, and he was drinking. And I was just kind of surprised. I said, Michael, you drinking? And he said, I'm 21. Now, of course, I wanted to say, you are, you're 21, but I think you're also an alcoholic. But, you know, I don't say that. I just said, you are 21. And I just pat him on the back, and I say, I know you'll sort things out. And then that's that, you know. I don't have to, and then I can enjoy him. I can enjoy him. I have no idea what God's plans are for my children. But I know this, that for some reason they were sent to me, and my job as a mother is to love them without enabling them. And the only way I know to do that is by paying attention to you, watching you and how you're doing it, and borrowing your experience. And it's been a wonderful thing. I listen as you share your strength and your hope. And that's how I do it. I listen. I don't care if you're an AA or an Al-Anon or where you are. I listen to the wisdom that you bring with you when you come into these rooms. And I believe you and I trust you. And I sit with people, as I've said before, who have lost their children. And I sit with people whose children are in recovery. But we all pay attention to our own recovery and we all walk the spiritual path. And that's why I think it's very important, you know, that 10th step, to continue to pay attention each day. Am I the woman that I believe God has created me to be? What am I doing that resembles her? And also to take a look at those things that I'm doing that doesn't resemble her. Because I believe that we're all invited to have an intimate relationship with God. I just simply got my invitation through alcoholism. Alcoholism broke my heart. The hand of God reached through that break in my heart, and the grace and love that I have been honored to enjoy has caused those wounds to heal, and that's a direct result of this program. Celtic spirituality talks about thin moments in life where there seems to be just a very thin wall between the world and the divine, and I've experienced those thin moments in this program. Or have known that I'm in the presence of God, oftentimes when I am with you. I have a daughter who, when she graduated, the speaker was telling us the story about when her 7-year-old son had finally memorized the Lord's Prayer, and he was so anxious to share it with her. And she said, "Okay, go ahead, what is it?" And he said, "Our Father who art in heaven, how'd you know my name?" I love that. I think of that often, because I can't imagine, given who I was, I can't imagine a better thing, a more wonderful way for God to bring me so close to Him than through the disease of alcoholism. It's not for everybody, but it worked for me. It was my invitation, and I honor that invitation. I honor the truth of who I am. And I got that. I really got that from you. There was a woman that showed up about a year ago, an older woman in her 80s. And I saw her when she walked in the door. You know how, you know, they don't know if they're in the right place. So I got up out of my chair and I went to her and I said, "Are you looking for Al-Anon?" She said, "Yes." So after the meeting, she said to me, "I don't know if I should be here. My son's 67. I said, "Well, sure. This is for family and friends of alcoholics. We're all here in recovery." And she said, "How long have you been coming?" I said, "I've been coming for almost 19 years. And she said, "Is it that you just don't get it?" I think she's serious. Anyway, I knew if I said to her, "I leak," she would probably be deeply offended, so I didn't say that. Anyway, so. Here's a woman in the city of Cincinnati. As far as I know, she's not in any 12-step program, but I do know that she's the best cancer survivor. And it just happens that I have to pass her a little restaurant every day on my way. In the morning, I'm one that gets up at the crack of dawn and swims. I just love that water. And so I pass it on my way to swim, and then I pass it again on my way to school. And when she recovered and she had received a clean bill of health, she has this huge, huge thing. What do you call it? I mean, this huge banner on the side of her restaurant that says, "Don't postpone joy." And I see it twice a day. And every time I see it, it reminds me of what you have taught me. That just today, and for me this has just been emphasized by all the events that have happened in our country in the last decade, just today I've been given this gift of life. And what I do with it really is, I suppose, up to me. But for my money, today, I choose not to postpone joy. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak.